At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If it's true that there is nothing like a deadline to focus the mind, then I imagine the White House is pretty focused right now. Because once the Senate said no deal to Detroit, that bankruptcy clock started ticking. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Friday. It is the 12th of December today. And the date matters because as of right now, there are 19 days left in this year. That would be the same 19 days that are left until General Motors has said it's going to run out of money. Congressional Democrats in the White House thought they had a deal that would have solved Detroit's problems, at least in the short term. But their $14 billion loan package didn't survive a Senate vote last night. So pretty early this morning, all eyes turned back to the White House. And sure enough, the executive branch is now considering doing something it said earlier was out of the question, taking some of the $700 billion in the TARP, that's the Troubled Asset Relief Program, of course, to keep carmakers going at least until the new Congress convenes in January. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is following the story today. Hiya, John.
Hello, Kai.
All right, so what happened that the White House had this change of heart?
Well, you know, I think they're really worried about who's going to get the blame if one or more of these companies goes under, especially since they've already poured hundreds of billions of dollars into the banks. The car problems are really cascading out into the already shaky economy. You know, GM announced today that they're going to temporarily shut down 20 or more factories just because they have so many unsold cars on their lots. And some dealers say that their banks have begun pulling in their loans or mortgages. Lenders, after seeing what the Senate did yesterday, began calling dealers and parts makers saying, show me the money. Where are you going to get the resources to pay next month's loan payment? So I think the White House is kind of concerned.
Well, let's check on that money. How much is left in the TARP that the government can spend?
Well, Congress gave Treasury half of the $700 billion, telling the Secretary, you're going to have to come back to us for the second $350 billion. So far, Treasury has obligated $335 billion. Most of that is already out the door. And that leaves, very conveniently, $15 billion, which is very close to the amount that GM and Chrysler say they need just to get them through the end of January.
John, very quickly, any talk at all of Treasury going back for that extra $350 billion?
They might do that, but Congress doesn't seem in the mood to grant Treasury more money. You know, if they ask for this, it's going to open up the administration to loads of bipartisan criticism of the way that the money's been spent so far.
Yeah. All right, back to cars. Any other options for Detroit beyond the TARP?
Well, there's some talk that the Federal Reserve could cover loans for the industry, and the Fed hasn't ruled it out, but it really does get way beyond the Fed's normal jurisdiction, which is just overseeing financial institutions. But hey, Kai, there's something we can all do, you know. Michigan's Governor Jennifer Granholm says she's buying automotive stock for her kids for Christmas.
The price is right. It's a great way to support the home team. If you can get credit, buy an American car now.
The price is right. I love that one. What happens now, though, John? Congress is gone. Where do we go?
Well, that means it's up to the executive branch. Reporters have been told that there will be no announcements until next week, and that's despite some real pressure from Congress and governors who say that without the certainty of a rescue, layoffs and these other repercussions will continue. They're hoping that a rescue loan will be announced this weekend.
All right, it's going to be an interesting end of the year. John Dimsdale in Washington. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Guy.
You'll be happy to know at least one small slice of the financial crisis might not wind up in taxpayers' laps. The government agency that backs private pensions filed suit in New York today. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation is trying to make sure Lehman Brothers remains firmly on the hook for almost $1 billion in pension benefits for its employees. Earlier this week, Congress gave both corporations and retirees a pension break. Lawmakers relaxed rules on mandatory withdrawals from IRAs and 401ks for people over 70. At the same time, they also let businesses delay payments to those pension plans. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
A few years ago, Congress told employers they had to fully fund their pension plans. But this week, Congress let businesses off the hook for billions of dollars in contributions. Beth Almeida heads the National Institute on Retirement Security. She says the funding requirements couldn't have come at a worse time for companies struggling through a bad economy.
Now, when you layer on top of that additional requirements to contribute additional dollars into pension plans, it really is like a double whammy for employers.
But is Congress setting itself up for a whammy or two in the future? After all, the lawmakers wanted companies to fully fund their plans so the government insurer known as the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation wouldn't have to take them over. Will it eventually need a taxpayer bailout? Dallas Salisbury says no. He heads the Employee Benefit Research Institute.
They've got a lot of money in the bank, and they pay out pensions at a relatively slow rate, and that means that your money can last for a long time.
So no bailout there. But the government might need to do more for retirees. This week's legislation says people over age 70 don't have to withdraw money in IRAs or 401ks. But Mark Erie of Brookings wonders, what about seniors who can't afford to leave their money alone?
Most retirees need to live on their retirement savings. A lot of people will have to take money out in any event.
And that money will be taxed. Ivory says the least Congress can do is let these seniors withdraw a certain amount tax-free. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There weren't too many withdrawals on Wall Street today, that despite Detroit walking right up to the edge of bankruptcy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Every day in this crisis brings some new tidbit of information, and today did not disappoint. After wallowing at record lows for months now, consumer confidence actually bumped up last month. Do you suppose it's a coincidence that gas is $1.65? We asked Sally Herships whether cheap prices at the pump are really enough to put smiles back on shoppers' faces.
Brooklyn taxi dispatcher Yesenia Gonzalez is a confident consumer. On a scale of 1 to 10, she says she's at 9.5.
My gas tank was $50. Now it's $30. So I feel happy that I'm spending less on gas. I'm going to spend somewhere else. Absolutely.
A few blocks away, Carolina Perry says she's from Venezuela. She knows her oil. The low prices make her pocket feel good. But she's still concerned.
This could be a long-term recession, and I myself don't feel any more confident than I was, you know, back in September.
So one consumer is confident, the other not so much. What's going on? Economist Gary Schilling says last month's uptick in consumer sentiment is small. Consumers are still down in the dumps.
Even when they're paying less at the gasoline station, they're not turning around and spending that like drunken sailors on Christmas goodies.
Schilling says America has been on a buying and borrowing binge for 25 years, and now the tide has turned. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
So consumers are feeling better. Great. Maybe now we'll all start buying more stuff, the economy will turn around, and by springtime, this whole mess is a distant memory. Or maybe not. But either way, commentator Rob Walker says now's a good time for us to take a hard look at our habits, not just what we consume, but how.
Lots of us are having second thoughts at the point of purchase these days. But if the economy has you feeling like you want to change your shopping habits, don't just think about it when you're standing in front of the cash register. Think about it when you're standing in front of your stuff.
The ads and the sales promotions we're bombarded with all point to the moment of purchase, and admit it, that's the part of shopping we focus on too. It feels good to get the latest tech toy or the new pair of premium denim jeans or the great deal on 400 thread count sheets. That's the consumption climax, but it isn't the end of the story. That comes on the inevitable day when whatever you bought is used up, obsolete, or found neglected in the back of the closet. We go to one store or another every week for new stuff, but we don't spend a lot of time dwelling on our old stuff. Instead, we put that off, maybe because it can be an uncomfortable moment of truth. Where did I get all this stuff? Actually, that's exactly why you shouldn't avoid such moments. For starters, it's worth trying to wring some satisfaction out of how we get rid of things, how we unconsume. Just replace that perfectly good tech toy with a newer one? Well, finding your unconsumed possessions a new home through FreeCycle, Craigslist, or even Goodwill feels better than throwing them out in a big purge before you move. But the more lasting payoff is that embracing unconsumption moments instead of avoiding them offers a whole other way of evaluating your consumption habits, for better and for worse. Those premium jeans went out of style way before the denim wore out, but those sheets were actually worth the money. You'll learn a lot more from your own stuff than you will from the latest sales promotions, and it might just change the way you shop.
Rob Walker writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. His latest book is called Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Tell us who you are, what you buy, anything you like. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Here's the thing about this week. You take the near death of Detroit out of the equation, and it's been more normal than things have been in a long time. For our weekly wrap of what's been happening on Wall Street and beyond, we've got Andy Brooks with us. He's a chief trader at T. Rowe Price, and Lee Gallagher. She's at Fortune Magazine. Hi, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Andy, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to be a little bit leading here. And I'm going to ask you whether there's any sensibility of a bottom, given what's been going on this week.
As you know, I tend to be optimistic, so I think I can answer your question. You know, either we're seeing the calm before the storm, or the market really is bottoming. And,
all right, wait a second. You mean we haven't just had that big storm the last two months?
We've had about a 20% rally off the bottom, if you will. So there's been a pretty good market here in the last couple weeks, but we're starting to see bad news that gets to the market and is not being terribly received. And by that I mean the market's not selling off in a big way when bad news is announced. And today we had some bad news about a big hedge fund that was blowing up. And the markets, for the most part, had a pretty good session.
Lee, let me take you back farther in the week to Monday, which came obviously after last Saturday and Sunday, which is when the president-elect announced that big stimulus package that he wants to get through. Did that sort of start things off on a good foot?
I think that definitely set the tone, and we definitely saw the results of that earlier in the week. You know, the market right now is just so incredibly sensitive and incredibly emotional, and things like that are really going to have an impact. So, you know, I think you need to bear that in mind.
Lee, let me ask you about the credit market, since that's, in theory anyway, how we got into this whole mess, and it's arguably a better indicator of where we are. Things are actually getting better there, too, aren't they?
Well, they are if you look at the parts where the Fed or some other agency has intervened. Banks are still not lending the way that they ideally would be lending, and there's still quite a few problems in the credit market, and I think that's going to take quite a bit to unwind. And, you know, I'm not so sure we're near the bottom with the stock market. I mean, I think that there's a feeling out there that the risk is greater to be out of the market than to be in it.
Right.
But that doesn't mean we're not going to go down from here.
Andy, talk to me about some of those risks that still exist in the market. The one I can think of is unrealized losses that the banks are going to have to declare sooner or later.
Yeah, and you know, when you see somebody take a charge to reflect a loss, that means everybody else has got to remark their portfolios. So there's still, I agree with Lee, I think there's substantial risks. And the credit markets, though they're improving, they're still pretty frozen in some ways. And the Treasury sold T-bills this week with a 0% interest. So at some point, you wonder when even prudent investors are going to start to say, I got to step out a little bit here and increase my risk profile and start to earn something that can fight inflation and give me a decent return. And until we see those spreads start to narrow, I think we're still struggling. But there have been some pretty good moves here off the bottom. And when you get good news like what Mr. Obama suggested on infrastructure spend, stocks can really fly.
Lee, I want to pick up on something that we talked about earlier in the broadcast. You know, consumer sentiment did tick up this past month. Can we draw anything from that?
I think you can draw a little bit from that. Sales after Thanksgiving, the Black Friday sales, were better than most people expected them to be. But I do think that there's still this sense of fear, especially when it comes to consumer spending, as more and more big blue chip companies are laying people off by the thousands still, and we may see more of that.
Assuming, though, that things are relatively quiet news-wise for the next 2 weeks, which I know is sometimes an assumption, where do we stand as we look into the new year? Andy?
All the tax loss selling that's been going on and deleveraging and hedge fund unwinding, all that stuff ought to be behind us. And then maybe we'll start looking forward to, you know, turning the page. And I think everybody from Main Street to Wall Street can't wait to turn the page and get into 2009.
Yeah, there's no doubt that we're all sick and tired of 2008, Lee. But do you think it's actually going to change in the short term in 2009, or are we going to be dealing with this for a while?
Well, I think Andy's right. I think that that sentiment, there's something to that. You know, we say in our investor guide this year that after a bear market, whenever the bottom is, it tends to come back very quickly in big surges. So, you know, people aren't going to want to miss that.
Let me see if I can frame it this way. We are closer to the end than we are to the beginning, right?
Let's hope so.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, Andy Brooks at T. Rowe Price. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, down times have many looking for a higher cause.
We're stripped down, we've lost a lot, we're worried, we're fearful, but you know, all is not lost.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 0.75% today, 64 points, closed at 8,629. The NASDAQ put on 0.2%, 32 points, ended at 1,540. The S&P 500 added 0.7%, 6 points. Finished up the day and the week at 879. For this past week, the Dow traded down just a fraction. The NASDAQ actually rose 0.2%. The S&P 500 was up 0.4%. Reports that the automakers might not end up as roadkill brought mixed results, actually. Ford gained 0.4%, but General Motors lost nearly the same amount. There was even some good news on the real estate front today. General Growth Properties built up 25% after refinancing its debt. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.58%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for November. Time to get everything in the mail. The post office bets Monday will be its busiest day of the holiday season. And Bill of Rights Day is observed. It marks the anniversary that the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution went into effect on December 15, 1791. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, it's a wonder we trust anybody on Wall Street given the ringing we're going through. But this next story, I got to tell you, really takes the cake.
Bernard Madoff used to be the chairman of NASDAQ, as in the NASDAQ. He's also, it turns out, one of the greatest liars and cheats Wall Street's ever seen. The FBI says Madoff confessed to running a giant Ponzi scheme, so giant enough to have lost investors more than $50 billion. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more now from New York.
It's a classic Ponzi scheme. A dishonest broker sets up an elaborate house of cards and basically robs Peter to pay Paul.
You take the money from new investors to pay old investors.
Mitch Zukov is the author of the book Ponzi Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend. When it comes to Bernard Madoff's heist, he says,
he out-Ponzied Ponzi.
Madoff kept sending out statements showing an unusually healthy annual return, and investors told their country club friends to join in. Zukov says Madoff got away with it for some of the same reasons Ponzi did.
If he's anything like the original, Charles Ponzi was enormously charismatic, absolutely conveyed confidence and comfort, and he just looked as though he was the guy to trust and behaved in a way that made people want to give him their money.
If the allegations prove true, attorney Ted Eppenstein will probably end up representing people who got scammed by Madoff.
Even already this morning, before I left the house, I got a call.
Eppenstein has dealt with cases like this before, but never one this big. He says Ponzi schemes typically fall apart in recessions because there aren't enough new investors to pay off the old ones. But he says it doesn't seem to discourage the schemers.
People who are bright enough to develop the schemes believe that they're above it all and that they can just keep going and going and going, sort of like that rabbit who gets wound up.
Maybe 70-year-old Madoff didn't figure the biggest financial crisis of his life was on its way. He himself reportedly expects to go to jail. Whether investors will get any of their money back is the $50 billion question. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We're going to take some time this Friday afternoon to step back and continue with taking stock, our occasional conversations with people who can give us the longer view of our immediate economic situation. As the fallout from the financial crisis continues to spread, people are feeling a whole range of emotions, fear, anger, and sadness, probably, hopefully, a little guilt for some of them. Reverend Mark Bazzuti Jones has spoken to a whole lot of people who are feeling all of those things. He works right at the heart of this economic storm at Trinity Church, the Episcopalian parish on Wall Street. When we spoke, I asked him what message he's been trying to get across to his congregation.
On one level, I'm reminding them, you know, that there's bad news in the market, but what we're about as a spiritual people is to embrace the good news, that no matter how dark it gets, there is a light. So I'm somehow reminding them, you know, okay, you have been blessed on so many levels. You have so many things, but don't lose sight of what is more important. And I think being generous, especially in difficult times, being loving, being patient, and being creative, that all these talents and all these skills and all these human traits, we can't lose sight of those.
Those are great attributes and important. I think, though, if you asked people what they thought the main attribute of Wall Street was during this whole mess, they would probably come up with one word, and it would be greed, right?
There is a lot of greed in this country. I mean, one may say that on one level, part of what makes capitalism such a viable tool is part of the greed. But I like to encourage people, you know, not to be too eager to point the finger at others and say greed, because, you know, on so many levels, I think we're all culpable in this market meltdown. I think for me, I'm recognizing too that there's been a lot of exploitation of others. Again, that's connected to greed. But I think on a personal level, people have given into this desire to buy and to possess and to cling to things and given into this pleasure principle that has somehow caused all of us to lose sight of basic common sense, which is like, you know, don't spend more than you have.
So is there a sin here, do you think?
I would like to say, yes, there is the sin. There is the sin of greed. But also, there's the sin, you know, and I want to say this in the gentlest of terms, you know, there's the sin of stupidity.
There is another thread that runs through this whole conversation, too, and that, of course, is anger.
It's funny, you know, on Sunday I was preaching and I was telling them about Macbeth, you know, when Macbeth got angry about the loss of his wife. And again, Macbeth, with his greed and his own stupidity, developed a life that was kind of built on tragedy. At the peak of all the tragedy, you know, Macbeth turns around and says, "Life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." And then I said to the congregation, "But you know, there are other ways of responding when we're angry." And I pointed to C.S. Lewis, that when he lost his wife and he was so devastated and angry at God because he was really in love with this woman, but something within him said, "Let me sit with this anger and let me sit and try and discover how anger can eventually lead to joy, how despair becomes joy in the end." And he went on to write several books about how, you know, in tough times and in difficult times, humanity, if we pay attention and if we don't allow the anger or the hate or the despair to destroy us, that we can move into what he describes as unspeakable joy.
A lot of what we've been talking about today, Reverend, is about materialism and about greed, right, and about the desire that we have in this country to just have more things. And this is certainly right, the season, the Christmas time,
right,
where that plays out in the fullest. How do you deal with that thread in this kind of economy?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I was also telling the congregation yesterday, and I said to them, think for a minute. Here we are. We live in New York City, and most people who live in Manhattan live in very small quarters. You know, we almost live in matchboxes, you know. And I said to them, think for a minute. 90% of us do not need one more thing. And so we have to find ways of rediscovering what it means to celebrate the season of light, you know, at Hanukkah or, you know, the Christmas season, to find ways of being generous, being with each other. And I certainly am encouraging the congregation, you know, to give yourself. Open up your heart. Be present to someone. Be there. And I also want to remind them that, you know, what we celebrate as a Christian people when we come together around Christmas is really the celebration of a poor, humble family, a child who was helpless, born on the outskirts of society, and who, through love from his parents and those around him, became a human force to be reckoned with. And so much of our society today resembles that manger. We're stripped down. We've lost a lot. We're worried. We're fearful. But you know, all is not lost. The light will shine in the darkness, and the best is yet to come.
The Reverend Mark Bazzuti-Jones from Trinity Church on Wall Street in Manhattan. Reverend, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
You can hear other interviews in our series Taking Stock on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, as Washington gets ready for the Obama inauguration, the McCain campaign is wrapping up loose ends. It's selling off old office equipment, couches, pretty much anything that's not nailed down. Prices are pretty good, too. Computers for $400, Blackberries for $20. Which is where they got into trouble. The local Fox affiliate in Washington, D.C. bought a couple of those Blackberries, charged them up when they got back to the office, only to find them loaded with what were, until now, private cell phone numbers for a whole slew of politicians and lobbyists and journalists, too. Can you hear me now? That is Marketplace on this Friday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 64 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ gained 32 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 added 6 points. That is 0.7% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, the market economy takes a hit in Europe.
people think that, oh my God, the market economy is over. I don't believe in the market economy. I need a very strong state, very strong government to help me out.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.